Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use and cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Mark. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have had the opportunity to get to know each other over the last several years. You were on my book launch team with the first book, and here I am working on my second book, and I have not had the pleasure of having you on the podcast, so I'm glad we've coordinated this. One thing you may not know, Mark, is some of the advice I was given after having promoted that book, that first book for about 6 months, is somebody told me, Jason, you can't promote a book forever. And so I transitioned all that energy that I was putting into that small little book and put it into this podcast. And so I've spent the last 2 years building quite an audience. Hopefully this platform will become an extraordinary resource and network for releasing the next one. But that's enough about me. Mark, how about we let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. I'm Mark Pablo. I currently serve as the Chief Development Officer for the Children's Defense Fund, which is a national advocacy and community nonprofit. I've been doing, been in the nonprofit sector for over 30 years. There isn't much that I haven't seen, and there isn't much that surprises me anymore, which is both a good and a bad thing. But I will say I am always learning something new every day. That's my goal, right? Unfortunately at this age, you know, occasionally sometimes the thing that I learned is something that I learned 20 years ago and forgot and had to be reminded of. But I think curiosity and learning keep you, you know, help you with the resilience you need to stay in this work, because it's difficult.
Yeah. So, Mark, you are, and totally coincidentally, but folks, for my listeners' sake, we don't know when we're going to be broadcasting this, but this is the morning of the inauguration, 1/20/21. And Mark, tell us where you're at and tell us what it feels like to be where you're at right now.
Yeah, well, I'm in Washington, D.C., about six blocks from the Capitol building. So 2021 has had an interesting start.
Yeah, it has.
And we're here. We're all hoping for a relatively boring inauguration day, but we'll see how it goes. I've got friends from the National down the street on both sides of my building, so at least I'm well protected.
Yeah, no kidding, Mark. You know, it's interesting. I saw an interview on NBC or something last night. You know, any other time in Washington, D.C. on this particular day, you wouldn't want it to be a boring day, right? But here we are in this sort of this tragic time, this sort of, I guess we could call it sort of a melancholy moment in our history. And you just really want it to just be a quiet, boring day in Washington, D.C., I guess. Yeah. What was it like? So if you're six blocks from the Capitol, you got to tell me about what it was like 2 weeks ago.
It was very intense.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's sort of easy to sanitize something after the fact, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was not a sanitary moment.
Yeah.
You know, it was really intense. And, you know, I still just feel deeply for the people caught in the middle, you know, especially the Capitol Police, who were just, you know, outmanned and outgunned in that situation. And, you know, on the one hand, who would have thought that that would happen in our country? But, you know, it happened, and it wasn't pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was sitting there, as we all are, I think I was working on my laptop or doing some writing or something. And all of a sudden, this news, and I think we're all watching what's transpiring, expectedly transpiring at the Capitol that morning, as we all anticipated it, and to be sort of a big news day. But we did not expect that sort of that activity to sort of take over the Capitol. So it was sort of a scary moment. Mark, you're a smart guy. You've been around a long time. You work at the Children's Defense Fund. I'm really interested in where you want to take this conversation today. I always let my guests come with a big idea or bold opinion. So what do you got for us?
Given that it's Inauguration Day, right, we think of change. We think of transition.
Yeah.
And I over the course of my career, have had the opportunity to, you know, be with nonprofits, either as a executive or as a consultant, through, you know, a number of different times of transition. So, you know, I'm thinking about that a lot these days. The Children's Defense Fund is going through has been going through a transition for a while now. Had a founder who, you know, was with the organization for 47 years in a operating role as president and CEO, you know, stepped down a couple of years ago out of an operating role, has continued, you know, in an emerita role. And in the organization just recently onboarded its new president and CEO after almost a 2 year sort of transition period. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about transitions and how nonprofits make those transitions successfully or not successfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we have I have a great deal of respect for your founder. And I remember the few conversations you and I had when we first met. How about you just enlighten us of what it's like? Because a lot of my listeners perhaps have not been around long enough as you have, and even as long as I have, to have worked for such a strong, strong leader with such a voice and having established an organization. What is that really like?
Yeah, I've had the good fortune, the blessing of working with some very strong leaders, and, you know, people that are well known and have really established legacies.
Yeah.
The founder of Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, is, you know, certainly one of those people that just is a legacy individual, you know, worked in, it's the first Black woman to be admitted to the bar in Mississippi, worked, you know, during the civil rights movement alongside, you know, many of the civil rights icons, as an organizer, really someone who brought the whole issue of child poverty to the forefront of the political, the attention of the political environment nationally, but also really engaged the academic community and others to take a deep, hard look at the reality of child poverty in the U.S. And then, you know, really look at what kinds of things can improve that situation, can be solutions to bring people out of poverty, especially children. So, yeah, she's a unique individual and, you know, has just left a tremendous legacy. And I have to say at, you know, 80, 81 years of age, she's still going stronger than a lot of people I know.
Right. So have you gotten to know her in a way where you would consider her your friend and you'd sit down and have a cup of coffee with her and she'd speak into whatever decisions you're making? Or what type of relationship do you have with a woman like that at this particular point in your career? And what sort of value and sort of like what sort of impulses is she sort of given to you that like, you know, when you make this decision next week, it'll be something that maybe she influenced?
Yeah, I think it's a little difficult when you have a strong founder paired with individuals who are also, you know, highly experienced in their particular fields,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And have, you know, in my case, you know, I have a pretty strong opinion about what it takes to do effective fundraising, and also what doesn't work. I think when you've been with an organization for a long time, you tend to go back to those things that worked for you, you know, at earlier points in time, right?
Yeah.
Which might have been, you know, 5 years ago, or it might have been, you know, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think having conversations about how do you adjust your strategy to, you know, the current environment, the current situation, the current circumstances, the current opportunities can sometimes be a difficult conversation because you're really coming at it, you know, from a very different vantage point.
Where do you think transition is going? Because here we are, we're about to transition the president. You know, the legacy that Trump's leaving on sort of our economy and on a city like Washington, D.C. and our culture and all those sorts of things. We talk about transition at organizational level like yours, but we're also talking about perhaps a transition outside of this very temporary sort of experience with COVID-19. What do you think the transition is going to look like? Let's just say that we're going to have the very, very fortunate news of maybe knowing that maybe this summer or perhaps in the fall, life can get back to normal to some degree. What is that transition going to look like? What do you think?
Well, I think I think whatever the new normal looks like, which I personally think is probably, you know, not going to start to become real until, you know, maybe the mid fall. But whatever the new normal looks like, it's not going to be the old normal. You know, I think too much time has passed and too many things have changed, you know. One example is the whole notion of a model where people come to the office every day and, you know, that's the way you do your work, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. Organizations that were not receptive to, you know, working remotely, they've had no choice. And I don't know if a lot of employees are going to want to go back to, you know, that kind of rigid environment. So I think there'll have to be a lot of accommodation. And I think certainly some easing back into whatever that new normal looks like, right? It might be, you know, some people working, you know, 3 days a week in the office, 2 days a week out, or vice versa, right? It may be, depending on the role, depending on the department, you know, you've got a, you know, a certain day a week, certain day a month where you've got, you know, team meetings, people come in, but then, you know, other days, not so much. So I think it's going to be fairly dramatically different. And to some extent, I think, you know, changes that we already saw on the horizon and sort of, you know, peeking out behind the curtains really got accelerated during this COVID quarantine period. You know, and to some extent that might be better. But to some extent, what we also saw, you know, coming out of COVID is just the structural inequities and the social inequities that exist in our country, in our society, that, you know, might have been below the surface now, you know, are really much more apparent. And yeah. I think how we come to terms with those, not just politically, but as a society, I think, is not going to be easy. I don't think it's going to be an easy thing to sort of get to a new normal where the reality of some of those things, you know, can't be swept under the rug.
You know, it's interesting you talk about disparities, because I haven't figured out how to articulate this, but you and I sort of share a very common context in our professional space. So I think you're totally going to get this, but I'm trying to figure out how to most accurately convey to our community, if you will, this idea that the disparities that oftentimes exist between the organizations that have historically raised significant dollars because of the existing networks and so forth, and the organizations that haven't. So we'll call them sort of the marginalized or the haves and the have nots, if you will. That I think this COVID reality is for some of them going to create this rationale that will maintain some of their marginalization, because I think they're not going to grasp. I think some of them, it's not going to click for them that, no, we're not going to do, we're not going to be sitting across the lunch table as often, but we're still going to have to find ways to create those high context engagements. You know, you and I are not literally sitting in a room together, but the necessity of us having a face-to-face conversation like we're doing right now is still very necessary. And I don't want to. And so what I'm saying is how do we convince those of us in this space as we're moving through this transition that, say, for example, being a major gift officer is still going to necessitate having a 45-minute conversation like this one that requires you to know how to listen and engage and back and forth, just like if you were sitting across a coffee table. Am I right?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It is finding new ways to accomplish the old things, right?
Yes, right.
And those old things are relationship building. They're, you know, deepening engagements with the organization, with its mission, you know, understanding the deeper motivations of the donor and what they really want to accomplish, you know, in their philanthropy. I think finding new ways to do relationship building is both part of the opportunity and part of the challenge. And I always, you know, I'll tell you, Jason, I am a contrarian when it comes to organizational growth. I'm a believer that challenges in the external environment, economic recession, other difficulties, obviously pandemic, on the one hand, can feel for many nonprofits like, how do we just make it through, right? How do we just survive?
Yeah.
And get to the other side of that when things can go back to the way they were before.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And you know, I'm a contrarian. I believe that's when you go big.
That's the work. I mean, that's the opportunity. You're talking about
that's
the messiness.
The opportunity.
Yeah. The messiness is the messiness is the opportunity.
It is, but you cannot be stuck in saying, well, this is the way we did it, or this is what worked for us before. At the Children's Defense Fund, we were very, very blessed in spite of COVID to have a really significant growth this last year, and we're tracking for very healthy growth again this year. But we've done a lot of things differently. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've had to move many things virtually. You know, whether it's, you know, internal working processes or whether it's, you know, events or other things. But we made a, for the Children's Defense Fund, a relatively big bet. You know, it's not a big organization from a fundraising standpoint. So, you know, it's not like, you know, we're $100 million, $200 million, $500 million organization. But we made a big bet in digital 2.5 years ago that had we not made that, we would not have been nearly as well positioned to not just survive, but really push for growth during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the things that you always want to ask yourself is, you know, not about technique, but about audience, right? Who is the audience for your organization's mission? And I would, again, from a contrarian standpoint, challenge people to say, it's probably not who you think it is, right? because the way you're looking at it is probably, you know, based in the past, and it's probably compounded with a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
And if you reframe your message, you can open yourself up to a much different audience. We had in March of 2020, right, when COVID kind of, you know, hit everything.
Yeah.
We had our worst month in the 5.5 years I've been at CDF, right? But what we did during that time, other than, you know, try to make this immediate adjustment, was really look hard at our messaging. And we made some important changes in the way that we positioned our message in a way that was relevant to COVID, right? We weren't sort of ambulance chasing, saying, you know, we were doing things that we weren't or couldn't, because that's not who we were. But we did really look hard at ways to translate our mission in ways that were relevant to COVID and to the current environment, and how it affected our mission, how it affected the population that we served. And we literally launched that new messaging on April 3rd of 2020, right? So we sort of missed the March. It was a terrible month. We launched on April 3rd. Unbelievable April. And every month after that, we just kept growing and growing. But our message, our mission didn't change, but we understood how to communicate our mission in ways that resonated and were relevant, but still authentic, right? And yeah. I think, you know, stepping back, getting out of your assumptions and presumptions and saying, you know, who's the audience that we could be reaching and how do we reach them probably in ways that we haven't been attempting to do up to this point. You know, to your point about major donors, it's been a amazing opportunity to actually spend time with donors, just not spending time with them face to face. But, right. You know, major donors have been more available for phone calls than has ever been the case.
Yeah.
At least, you know, in recent history. So, you know, it's changing methods, adapting to the circumstance, but, you know, in a lot of cases, those conversations aren't, you know, here's a project, you know, that we need your help with. It's how you doing,
right?
Right. How are you holding up?
Yeah.
You know, how's your mental health, right, in the midst of all this? How's your family?
Yeah.
And I talked to one individual who I've known for quite some time. Hadn't talked to him for a while, so we were sort of catching up. And he happens to be from New York, and this was. Had the conversation with them kind of right after that, you know, after COVID peaked in New York, and they just had, you know, an awful experience with infection rates and with death.
Right.
And I said, you know, how are you doing? He said, I'm really struggling. He said, 28 people in my family or in my circle of friends have passed away from COVID.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, A, I would have never known that, you know, in the course of our conversation, but B, it just struck me, you know, how powerfully impactful the circumstance is on people and on their, just their well-being. And how do we, you know, how are we attentive to that, right? How are we attentive to where people are at and how we can be supportive, you know, as they're struggling through, you know, these challenging times in the same ways that we are.
I was having a, you've got to have some insight into this, and this is going to get back to one of your comments just a few moments ago about who your audience is and not assuming that they are who they are, not making the incorrect assumptions about who they are. I was having breakfast with a gentleman down in Augusta, Georgia, right before the holidays, working on a capital campaign project with my client. And the gentleman said something to the effect of, this guy sells concrete, right? So this is a salt of the earth sort of hardworking guy, shows up at the diner with, you know, dirty boots and, you know, disheveled shirt on, nothing's been ironed, hardworking guy, makes a lot of money. And we were talking about sort of the polarization in our society. This is where I want to get at and hear your thoughts on this. But basically he said, you know what, Jason, we're in a pretty conservative community. We're working, you know, the school is a pretty conservative institution, of course. But he said, Jason, Democrats buy concrete too. And I thought, this is a guy, and this isn't a highly educated individual. He's just very much aware. He's aware and sensitive to sort of the polarization that exists in our society. But he's also very much aware that he's in the business of selling concrete. And he wants to be able to pay his mortgage and pay his daughter's tuition to the school and continue to build this thriving concrete business. And he's got to be willing to sell concrete to both the people on the left and the right. Do you think, Mark, and when you make the comment like you made a few minutes ago about being sort of wise to who your donor perhaps is or is not, do you think the nonprofit sector is going to get better at sort of seeing the danger in some of this polarization? I see throughout my entire career, I got to say, we're pretty good at polarization without sort of making it too obvious. But I think some of the opportunity in our sector is to sort of depolarize, is to learn how to, you know, the causes for which you all represent, for example, there's no reason that somebody on the left and somebody on the right can't be all about it. Do you follow what I'm asking?
I do. I absolutely do. And I think, you know, you put your finger on a really important point because it is easy for leaders of nonprofits to equate their personal beliefs,
yeah, and sure,
politics with, you know, with the organization, particularly if they're in the role of a spokesperson. And, you know, one of the things that Marion Rad Edelman is sort of famous for is, you know, working with whoever she can, whenever she can, you know, to get something done to help children, right?
Right.
And so she was very much a, you know, working towards sort of bipartisan solutions, you know, trying to find common ground.
Right.
You know, in the current environment of polarization, it's harder and harder, right, for people to sort of have that mindset where they feel the permission to find common ground, because they feel so attached to, you know, one side or another side of the polarization. But, you know, one certainly hopes, you know, given the kind of polarization that's just, you know, polarization in our country has existed for decades.
Yes, yes, sure.
Hundreds of centuries. You know, the last 4 years didn't create it, right? But it certainly took it to new,
right, to
heights
new levels
in the last
right.
4 years, or new lows, depending on your point of view. And you know, how do we come back, right? How do we understand, you know, country first, party second, right?
Yeah.
Our our society versus, you know, our personal, you know, partisanship. And, you know, you hope people can begin to come together around things that shouldn't be that hard to agree on. But, you know, again, part of what has made that so difficult is the environment where, you know, facts are subjective, right?
Yeah.
And there is no longer a sense of, yes, we can agree on an objective set of facts, because if your facts don't fit my point of view, then they're fake, right?
Yeah.
They're not.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a struggle, I think, as a country. For nonprofits, are they going to adjust? You know, I think there's an opportunity for nonprofits to break through in kind of claiming that sense of common ground. But I think the natural tendency of nonprofits will not be to go that direction. But I would hope that there are some that do see that opportunity to move beyond partisanship.
Yeah, it would seem to me like it maybe now is another opportunity for sort of a growth spurt, because civil society that we sort of represent, we're supposed to represent sort of almost the idea of sort of surpassing even the party or the sort of the country. But I mean, we're all supposed to be the most globally minded sort of, we're supposed to be the boundary spanners, if you will, in our society. We're supposed to know how to cross the aisle in all the different, you know, there should be really no us versus them sort of thinking in our sector. Even if it's subtle, I have found, I had a conversation a number of years ago with a gentleman who we were talking about education for, you know, second graders in a classroom. And he was on the complete opposite, you know, in terms of political spectrum that I would sort of identify. But he said, when you look at that second grader in that classroom, you know, there's not many political divides when you're looking at that second grader.
Right.
You know, she hasn't made many choices for which she's responsible for at this point. She's actually had a lot of decisions made for her by a lot of people and a lot, you know, in very different ways, be it her parents and anybody else in society around her. And for an organization like yours, it's pretty much the same thing. When you're caring for children that are in a situation like poverty, there really shouldn't be any polarization, you know? And there's so many different, and maybe that's the amazing thing about, maybe that's the silver lining in COVID, is that COVID has proven itself, which a lot of us have never, I certainly haven't, you certainly haven't experienced anything on the scale like this in your lifetime, but COVID, there was no bias, there was no polarization in it. It affected us all.
I mean, that's certainly, over time, that's certainly proven to be the case, right? I think initially we saw, you know, certain groups tended to be more impacted, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe of the kinds of jobs that they had, or they were in jobs where they were more, you know, subject to be exposed or whatever. But, you know, if you flash forward now, you know, from, you know, March of 2020 to January of 2021, you know, it's pretty universal, right? And you have, you know, demographic, racial, and even age group, you know, age groups impacted, you know, in ways that I don't think we ever envisioned. You know, I don't think we envisioned, you know, 23-year-olds getting sick and dying who were otherwise healthy. You know, it just, you know, I certainly didn't think that was going to be something that, you know, became commonplace, but it's, you know, over time, it's certainly proven to be the case.
Yeah. I read an article about a mother. So a mother and a son, I don't think there was anybody else in the household. You may have read the same article, but the mother has a son who's in his 20s. He has caught the, you know, he's caught the virus. He's showing symptoms. She drops him sometime in the fall, drops him off at the hospital, you know, drops him off at the emergency room. He never comes out. And the tragedy, you know, and I pulled my family together, you know, shortly after I read that story, we have a 18-year-old son, for example, the oldest of four. And I said, Gordon, if you contract this virus, you know, and you start showing those signs, I mean, the way this thing sort of plays out is pretty tragic. And so I think there's an awareness and it's a pretty universal, scary sort of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, I think how nonprofits adjust, you know, back to audience, you know, I think we all talk from time to time about this notion of, you know, organization-centric, you know, language, organization-centric communication versus audience-centric, right? Donor-centric communication.
Yep.
Time and time and time again, every day I'll see an email from an organization, or I'll see a communication, or I'll look at a website, you know, and in obvious and in subtle ways, you know, there's all this sort of organization-centric talk in platforms that are designed to be external facing, right? You know, we talk about our work, you know, we talk about help, support, you know, the work that we've done, right? It's, as opposed to, you know, how can we work with you to make a difference in, you know, an issue that you care about, right? Mm-hmm. And how can you be a part of impacting, you know, something that for whatever reasons really matters to you, right? As a donor, or as a prospective donor. And, you know, I think one of the things that will help any nonprofit kind of come through and come out of this pandemic is really giving a lot more thought to who their audience is and how is their communication effective in not just reaching that audience, but in engaging that audience in ways that that audience finds meaningful, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to in ways that you find meaningful. It's like, oh, we've got to get a message out about this report we just, you know, wrote, or about, you know, this project that we're doing, as opposed to helping people engage around, you know, what kind of impact, what kind of change is your organization trying to create, right?
Yeah.
And how can they, you know, be a part of it?
Isn't that the hardest thing to do, though? I mean, when we think about the people that stormed the Capitol, you know, 2 weeks ago, you think about all that sort of playing out right down the street from where you live. What you're basically calling us to, Mark, is an ability to, and I just read this somewhere else, you're calling us to sort of a willingness and an ability to sort of listen to those individuals and sort of understand where they're at and understand their circumstances. And there's been a number of writers, and I've got a couple of the books on my shelf. They're all from sort of disparate, different sort of parts of our world, but they've been able to, you know, certainly Hillbilly Elegy, that book that came out right after the Trump election. Those sort of authors have challenged us to sort of see and understand what was sort of playing out there in the minds of those individuals without sort of just this, you know, without sort of demonizing those people. Isn't that sort of both the challenge and the opportunity? And as we think of ourselves as both, in many ways, we oftentimes think of ourselves as fundraisers and marketers. You know, there were 5,000 people that perhaps were storming that building, but there were a lot of other people behind those people that I've got to know how to relate to as an organization.
Right.
Those people, I'm not terribly concerned about the people that were actually storming the building, but there were, there were another 100,000 people or so people that are still in your database at your organization right now that you've still got to relate to in the midst of this transition. Am I right?
No, you're right. And I think, you know, every, and there's a, it's interesting when I first came to the Tronus Defense Fund, you know, 5.5 years ago, and, you know, would have conversations with people, and, you know, the subject of, you know, at some point the founder would be transitioning, right, would be stepping down. And, you know, people would make the comment, you know, to the effect of, you know, I don't know how the organization can survive, right? And I don't know, you know, in my role, you know, being responsible for revenue, you know, I don't, you know, the donors that, you know, that support our work, you know, they're, you know, are they going to continue giving, and what's going to happen to the organization after that? Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly, I would listen to these people and, you know, be mildly surprised and even a little shocked at, you know, kind of all the assumptions that went in behind that. And you fast forward to today, you know, 5.5 years later, you know, 65% of the organization's active donors, you know, have come on new to file in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Right. They have no connection to, you know, the history. Now, 35% are still legacy, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's not, you know, one or the other, it's both and. But, and part of the reason that, you know, new people have come on board is we've employed different ways of reaching out and sort of finding an audience that isn't the same audience that we were trying to find before, right?
Yeah.
It's not that we don't value and don't appreciate and don't affirm, you know, the people who've had a legacy relationship with the organization, but it is also has to be about, you know, how do you grow, right? How do you grow your support base? How do you grow the movement that's supporting your work, right?
Yeah.
Whether your work is a, you know, a community focused nonprofit, or whether it's a national nonprofit or whatever it is, you know, behind you has got to be a movement.
Yeah.
And part of that movement is, you know, people that are in the trenches helping, you know, helping you meet your mission at sort of at the front lines, whatever that is for you. But part of that movement is also the people that are standing there supporting you, right? Faithfully and you know, that and how do you grow the base of your movement? Which includes growing your donor base, right? And finding new people that you didn't realize or didn't think about in the past as being part of your audience. And I will say things like going back to you know, the investment in digital, things like digital advertising have been a real boon to be able to really get not just bring in new audiences, but really drive a sense of, gee, it's interesting to see the kind of people that are coming on board that are responding. What is that telling us, right, about how our audience may be changing? And those insights can really help you make significant adjustments in not just your digital advertising, but in the rest of your, you know, your outreach and communication efforts.
Before I let you go, we lose our listeners at about 45 minutes, but I'm curious, listening to what you're talking about, because I know enough about your history and know enough about the Children's Defense Fund. I know I've gotten to know you pretty well. I'm listening very closely. I'm interested to hear about who that donor is. Like who has become your donor in the last couple of years, and say in the last 12 months, who has become your donor that sort of has surprised you? What sort of profile are we talking about?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. What I will say is we've had a lot of our active file, active donor file in the last 12 months grew by 31% over the prior year, which is, you know, by any measure, a significant growth.
It's extraordinary.
So good retention, good reactivation, and then, you know, good acquisition. A lot of those new people skew younger, right?
Sure.
But, you know, and some of them are like, you know, giving $5 and giving $10 a month and, you know, what they can. But, you know, our average gift on, you know, is coming in, you know, well over $100 for first time gift. Uh-huh. And we're finding a lot of, you know, a lot of younger people, you know, late 20s, 30s, I would say, you know, racially, ethnically, pretty diverse.
Uh-huh.
Not, you know, not necessarily sort of the traditional demographic that you might
sure.
think of. And you know, it's interesting if we look at, you know, our website audience, we're almost equally split in quartiles between 18 to 29 year olds, 30 to 45 year olds, 45 to 60 year olds, and 60 plus, right?
Yeah.
It's almost evenly split. And that's been I wouldn't say a complete surprise, but it's been very interesting to see, you know, that audience really step up. Obviously, people that, you know, are 60 plus historically for nonprofits still today are the sort of steadiest and most, you know, stable base of active donors and repeat donors. But it's very interesting to see, again, over the last few years, specifically new people that have come on board and what they look like, and also their willingness to not just give once, but, you know, give twice, give three times, sign up for a monthly donor program. You know, all of that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Right. You know exactly what you're talking about. You know, you think about your career and my career. A lot of the donors looked like you and me, right?
Right.
A lot of people on the other side of the conversation, the person that we were sort of receiving, there was always this, and I'm ashamed to admit this, but I'm just a pragmatic, honest guy, somewhat contrarian. Let's just admit that we've spent several decades receiving, you know, gifts from people that we largely assume look like us. And it'll be interesting as we begin to see the constituency that you're describing become much more of the dominant donor. And we might see patterns that are much more positive than what you might have expected from the, you know, the old white guys that were writing checks. It might be a more loyal bunch. It might be a much more, who knows what it's going to prove. But fundraising has built itself for a long time around, you know, older white straight men, if you will. And that constituency sort of going out the window and leaving with Trump.
I'm always a little cautious about binary thinking kind of at any level, right? It's like, it's either this or it's this, right?
Yeah, sure.
My view is oftentimes it's this and this, right? It's both and.
Yeah.
You know? So do we need to care and nurture for, let's just say the more traditional base of nonprofit philanthropic giving? Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah.
Do we need to find ways to test and engage and grow, you know, a younger and frankly, much more diverse audience? Yes, we do, right?
Yeah.
And again, that comes back to, you know, not just how are you doing outreach, but what is your message, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Is that message engaging and relevant or meaningful to the people that you're connecting with?
Yeah. Yeah, that Mark, and you guys are a great organization to do that. Folks, if you're listening, the Children's Defense Fund is an organization I've followed. I talk about them in my classes at the college. I got to know Mark. He was a part of my book launch team a couple of years ago. He'll certainly join up with the next book, I assume. Mark, it has been a pleasure to reconnect with you. Please stay safe. If somebody is listening today, they know how to find me. If they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Easiest way to reach me is through the Children's Defense Fund website, or my information's on the website under the leadership. You can reach me that way.
And I will put your, if you don't mind, I'll put your link to LinkedIn. You and I are connected that way. I'll put that in the show notes as well. So thank you, Mark. It's certainly been a pleasure.
Love the conversation. Thanks, Jason. Good luck.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.